The date is January. The date is January 16th, 2007. The place is Atlantic Coast Federal. The following interview is being conducted as a part of the Amelia I. Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Calvin Wayne Atwood. Date of birth, April 12th, 1924. Place of birth, Billows Falls, Vermont. My name is Frank Ofelt, and I will be interviewing the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reitinger, who will be operating the recorder, and Robert Hamer, who will also be assisting in the interview. We will now begin the interview. Mr. Atwood, could you tell me where you were born and where you grew up at?
Yeah, I grew up in Vermont and was born in Bellows Falls, and my family later moved to Rutland and Fairhaven, Vermont, which is in the west central part of the state.
Okay. And you were in high school when World War II broke out?
I was in high school and left high school early to work in a defense plant, and did some work there and tried to join the Marine Corps and almost did, but got appendicitis and had an appendix removed, and so I didn't get into the Marine Corps. I was inducted on January 2nd, 1943, although I tried to get in a lot earlier, and I probably have some papers on that, although I don't know that I do.
Okay. What made you choose the Marine Corps? What appealed to you?
I'm afraid that's so long ago that I probably don't have a good answer to that, except that I did understand that it was the best training, and I thought the best training might be the best chance of survival, not really knowing that the Marines got into an awful lot of trouble, and a great many of them did not survive, and I don't suppose that I realized that they were the first fight, and that if there was going to be action, we were going to see it.
Very well. So you enlisted in the Marines in what year?
I tried to enlist in 42, and as I said, I got appendicitis, and so I was not inducted until January 2nd, 1943. And when I first got to Parris Island, I thought it was heaven getting there from Vermont, where there was so much sunshine, and I thought the food was great, and everything beat the snow that I had been surrounded by just a few days before.
Okay. What was the training like at Parris Island? How did they mold you into that Marine?
I don't know that, except from books. I gather they broke us all down, and the drill instructors were plenty rugged, and yet nothing seemed terribly tough at the time. We ran a lot. We did a lot of calisthenics and marching and firing and of rifles and machine guns and throwing hand grenades, et cetera, et cetera. I wish I could answer that because I could certainly give a definitive response to why there is so much pride in the Marine Corps. And I know about that pride, and I have that pride, and everyone I served with has that pride. But it's a mystery to me as to how it all occurred.
But nevertheless, the Marine Corps training was the best that you felt you received.
I was terribly pleased with the training that I had, with the officers that I had, and I loved the men with whom I served.
Very well. After your initial training, your boot camp training, brought you to, did you volunteer for the paratroopers, or were you selected?
Well, you have to volunteer for the paratroopers. They didn't take you to that, and I felt like they were getting the elite or choosing the elite to be paratroopers, I knew that there would be extra training there, and that if there's extra training, then probably extra chances for survival. And we did get some great training, and I liked it a lot. I never jumped out of airplanes after I got out of the service, but I jumped out of them because I thought there was a good reason to, and there was a purpose at the time.
How many jumps were your basic jumps? Do you remember?
Six to get your wings.
Six to get your wings.
Yes, we did pack our own chutes, yes.
Did they have a backup chute as well at that time?
Yes, and they had a chute on front for emergency. I never had to use that, and I'm grateful for that.
What was that feeling like, that first jump out of the plane? Do you recall that?
The first jump out of the airplane was definitely not a problem, because you were trained to go down the cabin of the plane and out the door. And so there was, and we had done that on mock airplanes 100 times probably. And so it was extremely easy. But then the subsequent jumps, why one knew what could go wrong, and it was sudden gusts of wind or to get land in trees or to land in brooks or on rocks or something else, and a decent chance for injury. And so there was much more trepidation about the later jumps.
Very well. After your parachute training, can you tell us any other type of training you did stateside before shipping out?
They shipped us out after parachute training, and we went to a place called Camp Tarawa in Hawaii, and there they disbanded the parachute troops. There were only four parachute battalions, and I was in the fourth, and so the fourth parachute battalion never saw combat as a parachute unit. But the reason for that disbanding was they had discovered that the firepower was so great on each of the islands that probably 80-90% of the chutists would be dead before they hit the ground. And I think they made a great decision on that. And so at Camp Tarawa, they formed a new division called the 5th Division, and we trained for combat with that division. We trained for over a year at Camp Tarawa, and we kept thinking that we were going to get into other battles, but they used the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Divisions, and they held us back, and we never knew quite why we were being held back. Maybe we just needed some more training. But by the time we got into combat, I suspect we were one of the best trained Marine divisions, and it was called the Spearhead Division. And the five is the signal for the symbol for the division, and so a V for five and the V for victory is in the spearhead that we wore on our uniforms.
When you were at Hawaii, could you describe what that was like for you, knowing what Hawaii had gone through with the bombing of Pearl Harbor? Maybe a little bit about your whether there off-duty time there.
We didn't have an awful lot of off-duty time, and we were in on the big island of Hawaii, and we were about 80 miles from Hilo, and Hilo wasn't much of a liberty town. We were up near the two volcanoes, Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea, and a little later on, after we got on the volcanic island of Iwo Jima, why we began to understand why we trained where we did. And so it was probably the perfect spot for us to be training, not a great spot for liberty. I went to Honolulu, I think, once, and we did what everybody does on leave, and had a bunch of drinks and ate an awful lot of food, just because it was different from the food we were eating although I never complained about the food that we had in the service. And I suppose we looked for the ladies, and we generally had a great time. But I think it was mostly just being together, a bunch of Marines, and on liberty, and not parameterized by duty and obligation.
Can I just ask, did you happen to visit Pearl Harbor when you were in Honolulu?
Did you go I didn't go over there to Pearl Harbor, and we had so little money that to take a cab or anything like that pretty much determined what we could do and what we couldn't do. My pay was $50 as a private and $4 as a PFC, and $50 jump pay, and it didn't leave us very much left over for liberties.
Leaving Hawaii, did you head to another island after leaving Hawaii, or was the fleet, this time aboard fleet, were you heading toward Iwo?
Yeah, when we when we boarded ship from Hilo, we did head straight for Iwo Jima, and I think it was a 40-day journey, as I recall that. And I was on the SS Hocking, H-O-C-K-I-N-G, and mighty tight quarters, and we were stacked one on top of another and in the bunks, we did get to play cards and dice and of course did a lot of calisthenics and cleaned our rifles and re-cleaned them and cleaned them again, and we never stopped making sure that rifle was clean and or that machine gun. And after I got through the parachute training, I got into machine guns, and I liked that weapon a lot.
And what type of machine gun was that?
We had both the 30 caliber and the 50 caliber, and they were both Brownings.
Mm-hmm. And were you the actual gunner on the machine gun?
We were all gunners. We had a unit of four, and if you weren't running the machine gun, if you weren't the gunner, you were the assistant gunner, and if you weren't the assistant gunner, you were carrying ammunition, and then later on in combat, carrying out the wounded or getting water and ammunition. But we rotated, and all of us could run the gun.
Okay. Right. As you arrived off the island of Iwo Jima, what was that like to see the naval bombardment that was taking place there?
Well, a lot of noise, and I think the Navy felt like they were doing a great job for us. The Marine Corps had asked for 10 days of naval gunfire, and we got only three. I don't think we understood that at the time, that we were being shortchanged, but later we learned that not enough happened in terms of naval gunfire. And when you think that the caves and the pillboxes were 30 to 50 feet deep, the commanding officer's quarters were 75 feet deep, and the walls of the pillboxes and the bunkers were 3 feet thick, and the ceilings were 6 feet thick with plaster. So the actual damage done at the time was negligible.
Of course, seeing the fleet there, were you impressed that there was this large armada there and that you felt confident?
Yeah, I understood that we had about 60 miles of vessels, and then when we arrived there, of course, it just seemed like the whole United States Navy, or maybe the World Navy, was there surrounding Iwo Jima, and I think that was probably a comforting thought. There's so many vessels there and planes, and we had command of the airspace.
Very well. Can you tell me about the day that you loaded into your Amtraks?
Well, the attack started on Iwo on February 19th, and The first division, I believe, went in first, and the second division, and they went in around 0800 in the morning, and we went in around 1300 in the afternoon. And of course, you climb down the side of the ship. I'm sure you've all seen the rope ladders, and we climbed down those and into a landing ship. Vehicle personnel, really a Higgins boat, that where the ramp runs down in the front, and when they are ready to let the people down on the beach, and the there was a lot of gunfire from Iwo Jima, and a good many of the landing ship tanks and the vehicle Higgins boats had been shot up, and when we landed on the beach, everything was total carnage, and there were already a great many dead people and bodies eviscerated, blood in the water. The water was red when we arrived close to shore, and bodies were floating face down, and when we landed on the island, it seemed like everybody was dead, and there was nobody alive except for us.
When you made your landing at Iwo, what was your objective?
The 28th Regiment in our division had as its objective taking Suribachi. And so we went in just to the right of the 28th on their right flank, and our objective was to cut across the island to the other, to the ocean on the other side, and to seize the airfields.
Would you like to read?
Yes. I have a poem here from a book of poetry called Isle of You, and it's Reflections on an Iwo Jima Reunion. And I'm not sure that it's so much reflections on Iwo Jima as it is on reunion, but I think maybe it tells something about what those men were like and what they were about. We go to be with men who became Marines before their lives began. They wore forest greens, dress blues, and khaki slacks about the time they learned to tie a tie. We go to see a company of men who could strip a rifle or machine guns blind. We go in rooms and towns to lock ourselves again with those who helped us keep our lives, saved us for a living world, and a time of life we didn't know was ours. We walk and talk with them, bonded by shattered bones, small brooks of blood, shouts of laughter and pain. There is no need to call the gods of war, but more a need to leave that island back there 60 years ago, forget the taste of sulfur ash, the smoke and crash of flame that blew from every rock and cave. Still there is remembrance. No one here forgets the ones who died so young. We wonder if they came today, look to see if shadow figures are drinking bourbon at the bar, or if they shuffle silently around the flag. We don't talk much about the boys of war, but when we meet, we learn again the knowing that we always knew. They live with us, in us. They breathe with our breathing, laugh when we laugh, and they love us greatly in our acts of love. So we come to these places and gaze with laughter and love at all these stalwart faces of grandfathers and great-grandfathers who should have grown old but still could shoulder guns and run the hills of Kamuela. We shake hands gladly. We laugh a lot. We love their wives, their girls. Inside ourselves, we know if we don't gather here today, keep gathering, that some bugle far away will blow, and fewer every year will muster out for taps. And there will come a time when none of these Marines will stand and all the voices stilled who might have called the roll. Now, I think that doesn't reflect quite so much about battle or combat or what we were experiencing on Iwo, but it talks about the bonding and when we go to reunions, I hope that reflects what we're like and how much we think about the guys we left behind.
Cal, are you the author of that wonderful piece?
Yes, that's my book of poetry, and I have another one called A Squadron of Roses, and the other book is titled A Squadron of Roses because I think the men I fought with were like roses because they didn't last any longer than roses.
Mr. Atwood, how long were you on Iwo?
I got there on the 19th of February, and I was hit either on the 13th or 14th of March, and I'm not quite sure what day. We secured the island on the 16th. at least it was announced that the island was secured, but I know from later that a great many of my friends said there was still a lot of action going on until around the 30th of March. My company had 260 men when we arrived on Iwo, and all of them were either killed or wounded except for 12. 12 of them walked away unscathed. You might say they were apostles.
After being wounded, were you evacuated immediately off the island and moved to a hospital ship?
After being wounded, the only recollection I have at all is waking up in a kind of a jeep-like vehicle, and there was someone in a bunk above me, and they were sloshing blood all over the place. He was. And I thought it was my blood because it was coming all over my face and my chest. And I thought, I've really got it. And as it turned out, I had shrapnel and bullets in my legs, but was not wounded anywhere else except for some ash that had been blown in my face and in my eyes. And some of it is still there, by the way. But my only recollection is that of that Marine above me and his spilling all that blood all over me. And I thinking it was mine, I thought, I am really in terrible shape. But I drifted off and did not wake up again until I arrived on Guam and was given a bowl of ice cream by a beautiful nurse. And I thought that bowl of ice cream was the best thing I had ever seen in my whole life, and I'm sure it was.
Very well. How long were you in hospital in Guam?
I don't know how long I was in Guam. I was there for a month or 6 weeks and something like that, maybe 2 months, and then we got on a hospital ship and went to Hawaii, and we were at the Aiea Heights Hospital for a month or so, and then I went to Bethesda and Naval Hospital and was there for a while, and then reported in San Francisco at a hospital there, and I was an outpatient of that hospital and went in every morning to be checked and have bandages changed and that sort of thing while I worked for a motor transport unit that was sending jeeps and other vehicles to, I think, Guam and Okinawa to be used for the invasion of Japan had we invaded Japan. My company and my division did go into Japan and occupied Japan after the surrender in August. I didn't ever get back to my unit. I tried to once, but it didn't seem to work out very well. And then my mother had cancer, and my father asked me to get out and come home to Vermont, which I did. And then I went back to Rutland High School as a junior. I had mostly F's and D's before the Marine Corps. But after getting out, I had a lot more discipline and graduated as the outstanding high school student at Rutland High School that year. And then went on to college at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and graduated as the outstanding student there, and on to, for a master's degree at Columbia University, and won a Baker Citation for excellence. And for all of that, I credit the Marine Corps, because when there was work to do, I did the work. And if it took focus and concentration, then I did that. And I just, if the guys were going out to have some beers on Wednesday night, I'm not going out for beers on Wednesday night. I'm going to study. Now, I might on Friday or Saturday night, but if there's work to be done, you do the work. And I think the Marine Corps gave me that. And that's another thing for which I'm extremely grateful for. And after graduating from Columbia, I started teaching, and I taught English and coached baseball at the Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C. and for 4 years, and then went on to Istanbul, Turkey, and taught English there. American literature, and became a dean there of Robert College. An extraordinary experience for a teacher, and I lived there for 5 years. was married at the time to Carolyn Ruth Troop, had 3 sons, Wayne, Todd, and Nathan, and then went from there to a prep school in Kansas City, where I was the headmaster for 8 years, and went, that was Kansas City, Missouri, and then went from there to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and was director of placement for the MBA program and director of the MBA program and advisor to the graduate students, and did that for 8 years, and then 8 years at Emory University. And then for a few years after leaving Emory, 5 or 6, I think, I did executive search, and I had my own search firm called the Atwood Group, and found that to be a good experience. And I got divorced somewhere in the, I think in 77, and remarried in 1985, and an absolutely wonderful marriage with Carol Ann Horton. And she has 2 children, and we now have 18 grandchildren between the two of us. One of my sons, Wayne, is deceased, lost a battle with leukemia, and my other two sons are doing extremely well, and I have great affection for my daughter, Laura, who is Carol Ann's daughter by a previous marriage, but I think now she's mine, and great affection for her son, Bill Horton, and great love for my own sons and their children. I would say that I've had an absolutely wonderful life, and very few people, I think, have had the choices and options that I've had, and I believe I had them all because of the Marine Corps. If I had any wish, I wish I had stayed aboard, and because I know the Marine Corps would have seen to it that I got educated. My officers gave me so much confidence and had so much belief in me as a person and as a Marine that I think that's carried over the rest of my life. And I never thought any problem was too large a problem that it could never get solved. And I think I owe that a lot to the Marine Corps.
Looking back 65 years now, when you think of Iwo and the sacrifice that you and your generation has put forth, what comes to mind?
A poem comes to mind.
Absolutely.
And I think this might be unless you have other questions.
Go ahead. Go straight ahead.
This poem is called On Saying Goodbye. And it's saying goodbye to the Men of Fox Company, my company, and 2nd Battalion, 26th Regiment, 5th Division. And it's called On Saying Goodbye. I never was one to say goodbye. After eating a bowl of ice cream on the hospital ward on Guam, I knew I was back in the squadron of living. But while I stared through April and May at the legs of the white stockinged nurses and their starched behinds, I whispered goodbye to the men of Fox Company and all the other men in green that we left on the beach at Iwo. I never was one to say goodbye. And so with you, the day you jarheads closed the door of death behind, I heard doors slam on me 1,000 miles away, and overhead planes flew to airports where they'd never land. And autumn struck me then like bullets from the Nambu, gunned me down with light, and winter nights drizzled in me that will never blow away. I never was one to say goodbye.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your interview?
I think maybe I'll let that poem stand for me, and as it, I might.
We're ready.
So, Cal, looking back and listening to what you've talked about, when you were wounded on the battlefield and then transported back home, could you give us a little feel for the quality of the health care that you received?
I felt like I was exceedingly well taken care of, and I thought the Navy nurses and doctors were wonderful. The Navy corpsman that took care of us in combat and kept us alive until we could get to a battalion aid station. They were extraordinary. One of our corpsmen, George Wallen, won the Medal of Honor, and several other corpsmen were decorated from my company. And in fact, there's a book about George Wallen called Quiet Hero, and he is very much like James Bradley's father. And James Bradley's the one who wrote Flags of Our Fathers, and he is the most quiet, unassuming, modest, humble man you ever wanted to meet, an absolute beauty of a human being, and was then and is so today. And I see him at reunions, and he's just extremely modest man. And I think that probably characterizes almost all of the men that I knew, the men of Fox Company, who were, of course, the people I knew the best, but other Marines that I served with or got to know later. It seems that is the major characteristic, in at least of the World War II men, and I have revered that attribute in human beings whenever I find it. And the cocky, arrogant ones are anathema to me, because I knew so many who did so much, who were the great heroes of my life, and some of them gave everything, that characteristic of humility, it pervades them all. And it's so wonderful to see whenever I see it in young people today. But the care that I received on the battlefield and at the battalion aid station, on Guam, Aya Heights, wherever I went, Bethesda, I just felt that there was a great deal of caring and kindness and consideration, and of course an awful lot of it was with a great deal of humor, and I think you have to laugh at the whole thing. And I remember we used to steal pies from the kitchen on Guam for some of the guys that were really out of it, and stealing those pies was one of the most fun things I think I ever did.
I still get
really good care from the Veterans Administration today, and I have 30% disability, and I get checked twice a year, and I like the doctors. There's a doctor, Gene Raymond, at the VA in Jacksonville, and he is just absolutely wonderful to me.
Okay. Mr. Atwood, you mentioned briefly there about the Flags of Our Fathers, and now that that book has come out by James Bradley about his father and the flag raisers, and also the movie that has been produced by Clint Eastwood. Could you comment on that? And if so,
sure. I certainly read Flags of Our Fathers, and I liked the book very, very much. And I loved Bradley's characterization of his father. I don't know how accurate some of those battle scenes were. I was just with my company and what the other guys were doing. I didn't know very much about. And it's interesting that when you are in combat, it's your one little small splintered world that you know about, and it's mostly the people around you. And you don't have, as a machine gunner, a frontline guy, you don't have a view of the entire battlefield. And you're not standing on top of Suribachi looking at the rest of the island and wondering how everyone's doing. It is such a tiny purview but I liked the book. I thought the movie was okay. Black Hawk Down as a motion picture presented a lot more of the chaos and confusion and noise that's a part of combat than I felt that Eastwood's production did. I think it's important for people to see it, and certainly it clarifies that whole flag raising episode, which seemed to me minuscule. Who cares whether there was a flag that went up first and then another larger flag had to go up later? Somehow or another, the press wanted to play with that. And I'm just glad that we had the flag up there, and it was my privilege to see that flag go up, the first one. And there was great jubilation, great joy among all of us, partly because we were so glad to see the flag there, and it meant that we had secured the mountain. But also we had gunners firing at us at our left flank from Suribachi. And so we knew that pretty soon that would cease, and we could just deal with the problems we had up ahead of us and not be fired from the left flank as we were from Suribachi. And so it had a double meaning for us, actually the firing went on from the side, from the caves on the side of Suribachi, the right flank of Suribachi, firing over the airfields where we were, went on for quite a while after the securing, but we knew that it would be taken care of shortly, and it was, that was important to us. But I suppose one of the great days of my life was seeing that flag up there and knowing that we were going to be just a little bit safer, and that and even though it was I think that happened on February 23rd or 24th, the fourth or fifth day, and there was an immense amount of problems on up the island, but knowing that we were secure behind us was a pretty great feeling for all of us. And I don't know that there was that I have experienced more joy than when we saw that flag there, although I've certainly had a great many joyful moments in my life.
Well, would you like to go ahead and read us some more poetry?
Yeah, I'd like to read one more poem, and it's called Sculpting of Heroes, and it was written for my son, Nate, and trying to describe how I felt about the men with whom I fought. Sculpting of Heroes. I struck some 50 years ago, my heroes then, in hot gray light. Cast them exactly where I found them in my hands, as sculptors would, from jagged dreams, from night, from cold red clay. They leapt over wire, they ran, crouched, knelt. Who knows how they escaped from burning hands? A helmet with an arm around, machine guns flashing yellow fire, a bandage being placed where it would do no good, canteens down close to bleeding lips, M1s, carbines, blue 45s in strongest hands I ever knew, grenades in arms arched backwards near the ear, a shout of warning, waving hands across machine gun lanes, a rifle bayoneted, rammed downward in the sand. They stayed there 50 years, Marines, resting, sleeping on my mantelpiece of dreams. I kept them young in laughter, agony, and kept them mine. Only one or two who later came my way could tell for sure that they were really there. So scared was I to find them old, all those other wars and years between. I never dared to search them out to find them where they were, wherever they had gone.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think that's it. Thank you very much, all wonderful, three of you.
Wonderful interview, Cal. Thank you so much for sharing.
This now concludes the interview with Calvin Atwood, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps, the 5th Marine Division during World War II.